Accession number 4616, reel number 1.
Flight Lieutenant Lucas, Reel 1. When did you first join the RAF?
I actually joined at the end of January 1922.
And why did you decide to join?
I think it was because my father had been in the army all his life fairly well, and more or less I followed in his footsteps. But I went into the Air Force, which then, of course, was a fairly new thing in the country. And my father encouraged me to go for this. The entrance examination, I sat that in November 1921. And I passed and went to Holton in Buckinghamshire in January 1922.
Before we go on to Holton, maybe I could ask you what kind of a reputation the RAF had in those days.
Well, flying in those days was a great attraction, especially to a young person like myself, a great attraction because very, very few people, apart from First World War pilots, had ever flown. And very soon after we got to Holton, just to show that we really had joined the Air Force, they gave us a half an hour's trip in an aeroplane. And we could go out and tell the whole world that we'd been up in an aeroplane, which was very, very rare in those days, in comparison to nowadays, where it's millions and millions every year, sort of thing. But we were one of the very, very few that had been up in the air. In 1922, that was.
The RAF was very new in 1922. It was only about 4 years old.
Yes.
Did people regard it as a kind of upstart service? Was there anything of that feeling?
No, I don't think it was taken in that way. I think it was taken as a real coming thing in life. It was, I believe, in that way, it was a recognised thing that after one or two events in the First World War, like Zeppelins and so on and so forth, it was obvious that we had to have somebody to counteract the enemy. And the air seemed to be taking over from the ground, as far as those sort of things are concerned.
But what did the people in the Army and the Navy think to your service?
Well, I think possibly there was, hardly, but there may have been a little jealousy, but I don't know, we got on exceptionally well with both Army and Navy. In my experience, we certainly did.
Did you come across any instances of jealousy on the part of Army personnel?
No, I don't think so. Generally speaking, I think we got on very well together. Very well.
How much did you know about the career prospects in the RAF before you joined?
Well, literally, nothing at all. It was just a coming thing. To go flying was a wonderful idea, and as I say, the service point of view was bred in me. I was born in the army. In actual fact, I was born in an old army hut. You see, in those days, in Ireland, it was. My father was stationed out there, and I was born there. I was brought up in the army right up till just before the First World War, when my father left the army, but within 3 or 4 months he had to rejoin because the First World War started. So you may as well say that I was in the army or as such until I was 15 or 16 years old, at which age I went for the examination for the Air Force and passed that and went into the Air Force. I was in the Air Force before I was actually 16. So I suppose it was the service point of view that attracted me as well. I suppose that was in me.
Was that legitimate to join before you were 16, to join the RAF?
Well, I suppose it must have been. The examination was laid down the age limit when we sat for the examination. I still have the list of results of the examination. I still have that. And I don't think such things as limits for those sort of things really apply in those days like it does now. they're rather strict on you mustn't do this, that and the other before you're so old, but I think they used to take boys in the army at the age of 14 in those days, surely. I believe they still do take some of them very young, don't they? But it was run by the examination was run by the civil service, so it must have been legitimate.
Let's go on next to your days at Halton. What were your first impressions of Halton when you arrived?
Well, my first impressions of Halton was running up and down large hills, the Cotswolds, I suppose. And we did an awful lot of physical training at Halton. And we had a touch, I only say a touch of education and a touch of the technical side of things. Because I was only at Halton for approximately 4 or 5 months. And then 66 of us were selected to go down to Flowerdown near Winchester to go for the electrical and wireless trades.
Before we go on to Flowerdown, if I could ask you one or two more things about Halton. Mm-hmm. You say that you only had a touch of education
yep.
and the workshops,
yep.
but what were you doing for the rest of the time?
Mainly physical training. Did an awful lot of cross-country running. It seemed to me, whenever I think of Halton, I always think of cross-country running up and down hills. And I think while we were there, we had about a month's leave too, before, you know, summer leave when it came along. I think it was in September that we left Halton. And as I say, it seemed mainly to me physical training with a little technical. We were shown on the technical side, we were shown how to, in the initial stages of how to use a lathe and such things as that, you see. And we didn't, in actual training, we did very, very little at Halton, apart from what I just said.
What about drill? Did you do square bashing?
Yes, we did an awful lot of drill. Quite a lot. I should think we had probably had, I think it was 6:30, we were at Valley, and 7 o'clock we were out for physical training, having had one mug of tea first, and that would last till 7:30, breakfast at 7:45, and then back on the square for drill for probably 2 hours, and mainly physical training and drill in the mornings, and a little of the educational side of things in the afternoon. But when I look back at it, we did very, very little actual training at Halton, because I think we were more or less waiting to go to Flowerdown, you see.
What was the discipline like at Halton?
Fairly, to us, it was fairly strict, you know, coming straight from home sort of thing. It was fairly strict. You always seem to be having to stand to attention. And if you were supposed to be somewhere at 7 o'clock, that meant you had to be there at 7:05. There was no such thing as taking the risk of getting there at 7 o'clock and being 1/2 minute late. You had to be there 5 to 7. And all my life, ever since, if I have any appointments, dentist or doctor or anything like that, I always make that point that I'm always there at least 5 minutes beforehand. That was training from Halton, that was, definitely.
Were you treated fairly or unfairly?
No, we were treated very fairly, I think, because, as I say at the time, although they had some boys in the RAF, my brother was a boy mechanic in the flying corps, you see. They had them before, but we were the first ones which were coming up to this apprentice idea. So they treated us very well. The conditions weren't too good. We were up at a North Camp, which was 3 miles out of the main camp. And any time anything we had to do, we had to march down to the main camp. And time was a major factor. You always had to keep time. No, they were strict, but to my idea, they were very, very fair.
When you say conditions weren't too good, what do you mean?
Well, we lived in an old hut, and we had one fireplace in the hut, so it wasn't overwarm, shall I say. Food was, I should think that out of 21 meals a week, saying 3 meals a day, 21 meals a week, I should think stewed meat was probably 14 meals a week. The other 7, we might get a piece of bread and cheese or some such thing. On Fridays, we always just have bread and cheese for dinner. Food wasn't very good. It was enough to keep us going well, but it wasn't nothing nice. It was very nice about it, but it was good what we did have.
Were you ever hungry?
Yes, but once again, as I say, once again, we used to get 5 shillings a week pay, you see, at that time. Actually, our pay was 10 shillings a week, and we used to get 5, and they kept 5 back for us when we went on leave. And that 5 shillings was spent mainly on, as we called it, wads in the canteen. That's where we bolstered up our food. And, of course, by the time it came around to Friday every week, we were anxiously waiting for payday.
What did you do at the weekends?
Same sort of thing. Church parade on Sunday mornings, of course. Sunday afternoon, I think we had off, if I can remember rightly. We had Sunday afternoon off and, I believe, Saturday afternoon off.
Did you spend Sunday and Saturday afternoon in the camp?
We stopped in camp and or you went for a walk. We used to walk down to Wendover, the village, nearest village, used to walk down there. We didn't have such things as weekends off or anything like that at that time. But if Easter came along or such things, we had a few days off for that. And I believe they did give us a jolly good holiday, 3 weeks or a month's holiday before we left Halton, just before we went summer holiday, you see. No, I should say that they treated us extremely fair, and I would never complain about it, far from it.
How did the boys get on with each other? Was there any ragging?
Well, I suppose to a certain degree we used to pull each other's legs and all that sort of thing, but there were no spiteful fights or anything like that. Somehow we all seemed to get on very well. I always look back at those times with pleasure because I think I really enjoyed it.
Was there a prefect system?
Yes, you had a senior boy who was appointed. Invariably he went by the number. When we went in and we were given our number, you see, they started with A's probably, and A would be the lowest number. He might be the prefect for that hut full of people. And inside and outside the hut, he was still you could call it prefect, senior boy, you see. And I believe later on, I don't think it struck us at Flower Down, but I think they used to give us one little stripe or something if you were a senior boy. You know, a very, very, very small stripe on your arm to show you were a senior boy. But I think it did touch us at Halton, at Flower Down, but it was not till we just about finished at Flower Down so they started that idea. We otherwise it never seemed to be a lot of falling out.
How did the boys regard the senior boy? Did they respect him?
Yes, I think so. I think we all knew that he was given this job to do, and I think he was selected from more than one way, apart from his lower number, but he was selected, had some qualification. And I never remember any falling out or nastiness at all in that way at all, either at Halton or Flower Down.
Did any of the boys drop out of the course at Halton?
I never knew of one falling out. These days, I believe they give you 6 weeks or something to make your mind up, but we signed on for 10 years. At the end of January, we signed on for 10 years, and that was it. 10 years there it was. No argument.
How were you selected to go to Flower Down?
Now, I don't really know. I think we were asked, everybody was asked if they preferred electrical trades or fitters trade or whatever it was. As far as I remember, once again, I think we were asked what sort of trade we would like. If we want to be a rigger or a fitter or wireless or mechanic or whatever it may have been. We were asked, and from all those that selected, in our case, all those that selected the electrical trades were given it, I should think. I shouldn't think there was more than probably 100 people asked for it, and 66 of us went. So that was it. I don't know if the results of the entrance examination had anything to do with it, because I didn't come off extremely well in the entrance examination. I'd had a fairly good education. I'd been to grammar school for 4 years, but I was well down the list, and some of the people that were at the top of the list I know were very, very clever boys, they were, and they proved to be so later on in life. So I think that was the only point that they asked us if we wanted, what trades we wanted, and we were allocated from that. Most of us got the trades we asked for.
Were the wireless operators regarded as an elite?
No. No, I think it was taken just as one of the ordinary trades. There were riggers and fitters and all that sort of thing. I think probably the attraction of rigger or fitter was may have made people think that they could do more flying, you see, because as I said before, that flying was a great attraction in those days. Although, in later life, it proved the other way around. The wireless operator was the man who did more flying than anybody, in actual fact. Because we were trained, you see, as mechanics, born mechanics, we were later aircraft apprentices, we were trained as wireless operator mechanics, which meant that we had to do all the maintenance of all ground stations, flying equipment and everything else, you see, and also get into an aeroplane and operate the wireless in the air. So we had a very, to my idea, we had the best trade of the lot, but because we did more flying. In later years, I used to be rush around to go flying. I was always volunteering flying, but most other people were as well, because, as I said, flying was a very rare thing in those days.
Let's go on to Flowerdown next. What were your impressions of Flowerdown when you arrived?
Well, when we arrived there, Flowerdown was a wireless school, and there were probably a few men were being trained there. When I say few, I mean probably 50 or 60 men were being trained there. And suddenly, 66 boys, arrived there. We were put in a separate part of the camp, in a hostel of our own, and we put in this, and we got on very well there. I don't think it was a bit of a novelty to get away from 200 or 300 boys at Halton to get just the 66 of us at Flowerdown. And the 66 of us, of course, were divided into two or three trades, mainly wireless operator mechanics. There were electricians, and there were instrument makers. Three trades, you see, that were trained at Flowerdown. Mainly wireless operator mechanics we were. They trained at Flowerdown, they trained wireless operators as well as wireless operator mechanics. But the mechanic side, of course, meant that you could do any of the maintenance at all. I did quite a bit in the maintenance in my service right through, and I did quite a lot of flying. As I say, I was very keen on flying.
Can you describe what Flowerdown looked like?
Yes, it was about 3 miles out of Winchester, and it seemed to me that it was on a fairly high ground. It was on fairly high ground. And I know we had to go around with our dinner knife cutting the grass when we were on fatigues and so on and so forth. It was a very nice camp, very good camp. And actually, we were only there although it was supposed to be a 3-year apprenticeship, we were only actually at Flowerdown on our own trades for just over 2 years there. Because we joined at the beginning of 1922, and at Easter 1924, we'd passed out and was posted out on actual operations then.
Why did they use dinner knives to cut the grass?
Nothing else to cut them with, that's all. If the whole lot of us were probably not actually on fatigues, but certain days they said, well, all the grass around your hostel is growing. There's nothing else to use. You just take your dinner knife out and hold the grass up and cut it with your dinner knife.
How long did that take?
It'd be about 40 or 50 of us doing it, and it would probably take all the morning and for 2 or 3 weeks, so it would go on. It was somebody's idea of keeping things down and occupying the boys, I suppose. We had a fairly good chappy, a flight sergeant, who acted as sergeant major to us. Taylor, his name was. A very, very strict man. This was the sort of thing he did. We've got the grass to cut, and there's nothing to use except your dinner knife, so out you go with your dinner knives. That's all it was.
How did the boys react to it when they...
Oh, it took us a bit of fun, I think. It wasn't hard work at all, you see. It was just a case you did it, and that was it. If you got into trouble, of course, and you had fatigues, you had to go and work in the dining hall or the kitchen or scrub out something or other, and there you were.
What type of accommodation was it?
We were in what they called the hostel, boys' hostel. There was probably six rooms, each room holding about, well, it could hold about 15 or 20 boys, you see. And as new entrants came in, when we first went in, of course, we only partly filled the place, but as a new entry came along 6 months later, they filled up some more dormitories, you see. And eventually, I think we probably had 250 boys there in the hostel. And each room had probably up to 20 boys in each room, you see. Like hospital wards. That's the nearest I can get to it, I suppose. Like a hospital ward. I don't think we were ever cold, although, as I say, we only had the one coal fire in the middle of the room, but we were never really cold. The food at Flowerdown was better than the food at Halton, so we didn't do too badly there. And once a week we were allowed out, and we should walk down to Widgester, about 3 miles away, and walk back again, because you couldn't afford bus riding much on 5 shillings a week, although in those days 5 shillings wasn't bad, especially for a lad of 16-year-old sort of thing. So we didn't do too badly.
Can you describe the type of work that you did at Flowerdown in the workshops?
Yes. Initially, well, I think we carried on the training that we had at Holden, how to use a lathe, how to use micrometers and all the usual equipment with it. In the workshop, any mechanical machinery we were taught that would be applicable, we could do a fitter's job as well as our own job in a minor way, you see. Anything went wrong, you were expected to be able to put anything went wrong with your wireless equipment or electrical equipment, you had to be able to make parts for it. If you wanted a piece of metal at such and such a size, you had to be able to either put it on a lathe and make it, or file it down, or whatever it was. You were trained to do the engineer side of that sort of thing, you see. And then, of course, we did the practical side on the wireless, because in those days, in 1922, valves in wireless had only just coming in. They were quite a rare thing. We were taught about valves, because, as I say, they were just coming in, they were a new thing. But up till that time, we were still using the old spark transmitters and crystal sets for receiving. But before we left Loudon, of course, we were taught about the valve receivers and the valve transmitters. One thing we never struck at Flowerdown, which is rather strange, was RT, radio telephony, in the air. We never taught anything about radio telephony as transmitters or receivers, and yet when I left Flowerdown, I was posted to a fighter squadron where they were using transmitters and receivers, valve transmitters and receivers for radio telephony, you see.
Did they expect you to know about it?
Yes, because we had the theoretical side of things, you see. Doesn't matter what it was. If you had the theoretical side of it, there it was. I was looking at these examination papers, my passing out examination papers, and some of those questions on those passing out papers, it's worse than double dutch to me, and yet that's what we had to pass out on. They quote this and they quoted that, and it's double dutch to me now. I've forgotten it all. But they're very, very highly technical. There was no doubt about it. It was highly technical. We probably had training for six days a week, either educational or technical. And as I believe I said once before, the educational side of things seemed to me to be higher than what we ever had at grammar school. In fact, I'm sure it was. Things they taught us even on the educational side were things we never heard of at grammar school.
What did you think to the standard of instruction at Flowerdown?
Very high. It was very high. They taught us things that, at times, in future life, at times it came in very well. But quite a lot of it was so high that it never actually happened in practice. And as I say, these examination papers I was looking at the other day, they were, all the things were miles and miles above what I could answer now or could do now. And yet, qualified, so I must have answered them fairly well when we passed out.
Coming back to the wireless equipment that you were working on at Flowerdown, was it the best type of wireless equipment that was available at the time in England?
Yes, I think so. They, because it was just about the time when wireless was sort of coming forward. I mean, they reckon that most wireless stations, ground wireless stations, all had a whacking great spark transmitter, you see. And a lot of them were received, well, the majority were received on the crystal. You had to receive the messages on crystal, in Morse, of course. There was no telephony, as I said before, there was no telephony. You received it in Morse on a crystal receiver. But they were all spark transmitters. But directly we got away from flower down, although they taught us about the valves for receiving, and that was mainly on continuous wave wireless, we didn't actually touch any telephony on valve transmitters or receivers. And the standard of training on these things even then was very, very high. Very high.
What was the range of the equipment?
The range of it? Spark transmitters, crystal receivers, valve receivers, and just starting on transmitters for wireless. When I say wireless, I mean for ordinary continuous wave wireless, which is completely different, well, not completely different, but quite a lot different to speech, for instance. While I was at Flair, then we never touched speech on the radio telephony. We never touched speech at all. Well, everything was in continuous wave, and you had to read it by Morse, you see. We had some very strange things in that way.
But what would the range be in terms of miles?
Well, when I first posted away and we went on this telephony business, the range for to speak to an aeroplane, to actually talk to them in plain language, was 3 or 4 miles. That was the limit. We had a chappy that more or less was a flight lieutenant there that was allocated the job of looking after the wireless section, and he didn't know anything about it at all. He just had the job of being in charge of it. And he used to come and play about with his telephony, and I always remember he was an Irishman, and I always remember him trying to talk to the aeroplane. And if you can hear me, fly towards me. If you cannot hear me, will you waggle your wing? You see, this sort of thing. I always remember that. Yes, it was very interesting, as I say. It was a new thing. Wireless was a new thing.
Was reception clear?
Do you mean on telephony or on Morse?
On both.
Well, on Morse, and telephony, I suppose, but on Morse, in certain cases, you had a terrific lot of interference. And you had to tune out the interference and tune your own station in and all that sort of thing, but sometimes it was very bad. And the noises were mainly atmospheric noises. There was no other station interfering with you much, because there were very few stations about. And it was mainly atmospherics. Atmospherics seemed worse in those days, probably because we couldn't tune them out like they can now, can do nowadays. The equipment is much more selective these days. But it was quite a job at times. In certain parts of the world too, you used to start, the interference was very bad, you know. You get in the tropics sort of thing, you get a lot more interference from the atmospherics than you do in England.
What about the reception on telephony?
In the first instance, it was a limit of 3 or 4 miles. After that, you just faded out. But not a great deal of interference on that. Not a great deal of interference. No, certainly, it seemed as though there was more interference on the ordinary continuous wave wireless than there was on the telephony. What I remember about it. But that was mainly, as I say, because the range was so short with telephony.
How could you tune out the... You said that you could tune out the interference. How exactly could you do that?
Well, this is where the technical side comes into it, you see. In the old days, you probably just had a set of coils to that would cover a certain range, you see. But later on, they had another set of coils put in where you tune the station in first, and then you put it through another lot where you tune it again, you see. In other words, it went through two or three times it would go through, and each time you'd cut out a bit more interference and get more selective, you see. Where you just sort of, in the first case, you took whatever was coming out of the air. If you put it through 3 times, you could tune it, select out the station you wanted better.
How long did that take?
Oh, you do it on the spot, 2 or 3 minutes sort of thing, you see. Even less.